You've all seen, no doubt, The Incredibles, the Pixar movie. And The Incredibles is about a superhero named Mr. Incredible. And his whole family is actually a family of what they call supers. And so his wife is Elastigirl, and the kids, the three kids, have these special abilities and things that they, as superheroes, can use. However, what happens in the story is, in our overly litigious society, the Incredibles are forced to, all the supers in the world are forced to resign and quit and go live ordinary lives because there were too many lawsuits. The superheroes would rescue someone and they would hurt their back and then they'd sue the superhero and all this stuff. And so here this family is trying to wrestle with who they are. And one day they're sitting around the table, and the little boy, his name is Dash. And they call him Dash because he can run everywhere really, really, really fast. And so he got in trouble because he put a nail on the teacher's seat. And they couldn't catch it on the camera because he went so fast. And then he said, "I just want to be able to be who I am. I just want to be able to use my special powers." And his mom looks at him and she pats him on the head and she says, "Son, everyone is special." And then he folds his arms and he says, "Mom, if everyone is special, that means no one is special. No one is special." Well, what do we do with All Saints? It's an opportunity for us to look at those who have gone before us, those who we consider heroes in the faith, those who we consider over and above. But we'll talk about that a little bit. It's either some twist of fate or some twist of irony that All Saints always comes before the elections. And I know, I don't know about you, but I voted early, and I found myself with this melancholy kind of feeling. Because I think all of us look to the President of the United States, and we want them to be a cut above. And we think about those presidents of the past, maybe JFK, maybe FDR, maybe George Washington, maybe Abraham Lincoln, Eisenhower, Truman, pick your hero. And we think to ourselves, is this guy that I just voted for going to be anything like that? Because there's an instinct in us that says, we want to follow someone who is a cut above the rest. Now, of course, we need to be in prayer this week. Next week, we will pray for our president and for our president-elect. So it's very important for us to be on our knees. But back to All Saints. It is also fitting that we take Jesus' most important and most incredible sermon. And we say, if you want to know what someone who follows Christ looks like, if you want to know what a saint looks like, look at the Sermon on the Mount. Look at the Sermon on the Mount. Now, those of you who know the Gospel of Matthew know that in Matthew, Jesus fulfills all that the Torah teaches. And you can see the parallels even between Jesus and Moses in our passage. He goes to where? He goes to a mountain. And he begins to speak. Only he doesn't go up there to receive something. He goes there to give something. He doesn't go to receive the law, but to fulfill the law. He is greater than Moses. This is perhaps the Torah of the Messiah. You have heard it said, but I say to you, you have heard it said, but I say to you. And Matthew records at the end of the sermon, Now, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. The most quoted passage of Scripture in the first three centuries of the church was the Sermon on the Mount. When early Christians came to be catechized, to be taught the ways of the faith, the primary source they had was the Sermon on the Mount. And no doubt this was so important, because when you are marginalized, when you are persecuted, when you are cast aside, you need to know what to do. You need to know how to behave. You need to know what the condition of your heart will be. And no doubt those early Christians were poor in spirit. They knew how to mourn. They were meek. They hungered and thirsted for righteousness. They were merciful. They were pure in heart. They were peacemakers. If you want to know what a saint looks like, there it is. Those who have gone before us, the apostles, the prophets, the martyrs of all ages. If you want to know what their life was like, Matthew 5, 1 through 12. Matthew 5, 1 to 12. But you're sitting there thinking to yourself, how in the world can anyone live this way? We'll have to become monks. We'll have to become nuns. Well, Dietrich Bonhoeffer said in the 30s, and he wrote a wonderful book on the Sermon on the Mount. It's called The Cost of Discipleship. His idea was the restoration of the church, he says, will come with a new kind of monasticism, which will have nothing in common with the old, but a life uncompromising adherence to the Sermon on the Mount in imitation of Jesus. But can we really do this? Last week we heard about the great command, love God, love your neighbor. Love God, love your neighbor. And this sermon is really an exposition on that. How do you love God? How do you love your neighbor? Matthew 5, 1 to 12. You can't love God and love your neighbor without these principles. Jim Forrest says each of the Beatitudes has to do with dying to who? Self. Poverty of spirit, the foundation of the Beatitudes, is the ongoing process of dying to self. Not out of self-hatred or a collapse of self-esteem, but because there is no other way to love God and to love neighbor unless you die to yourself. Excuse me. When we talk about all saints, when we talk about saints, in the New Testament, there's good news and bad news for us. The good news is, everyone in this room who believes in Jesus as their Savior and Lord and has passed through the waters of baptism is a saint. The word means holy one, consecrated to God. When Paul was writing 1 Corinthians, he says, to the saints of God. You ever read 1 Corinthians? Ain't no saints in that church. They were doing all kinds of stuff. All kinds of stuff. And yet Paul says, because of who you are in Jesus, you have been set apart, you have been consecrated, and you are a saint. But the bad news is that all the saints are expected to live a life out of the calling that we have been given. So the life described by Jesus is an expectation of someone who is his follower, not a suggestion. Matthew 5, 1 to 12 is the expectation for someone who is a follower of Jesus. Not a suggestion. The kingdom of heaven is not a voluntary association. We don't get our ballot in the mail. We don't go in a voting booth and say, let's see here. Getting a little tired of Jesus. Time to get him out of office. Now, some of us do that with our actions. Some people never come back to church. They decide that's what they're going to do. But we can't vote Jesus out. If you want to be his follower, Matthew 5, 1-12 is the expectation. And it's not a suggestion. But how? How do we do this? I'm just going to take three of those Beatitudes and look at them a little closer. What does it mean to be poor in spirit? Again, as Forrest says, it means dying to self. Poverty of spirit, the foundation of the Beatitudes. To be poor in spirit is to realize that without Christ, we have nothing. Without Christ, we are nothing. It is not some morose way of beating ourselves up. It is a way of acknowledging our dependence on God. It's a way of acknowledging our dependence on God. Forrest says again, poverty in spirit is my awareness that I cannot save myself, that I am defenseless, that neither money nor power will spare me from suffering and death, and that no matter what I achieve and acquire in this life, it will be far less than I wanted. Poverty of spirit is my awareness that I need God's help and mercy more than I need anything else. Poor in spirit, perhaps, is too familiar to us, that phrase. Translated rightly, how about beggars in spirit? Beggars in spirit. Now, what do we think of when we think of beggars? We think of the guy on the street with a sign that says, help, I need more booze. We give him a couple bucks, he goes and gets cheap wine. Or help, I need food. Or help, I need a job. Or help, I just need something. That's our opinion or our view when we think of beggars. What if this week, you went to the street corner, Colorado and Alameda, and you held up a sign that says, help, I need Jesus. Help, I need Jesus. It'd probably be easier for people to throw you a couple bucks. They wouldn't know what to do with that. And I'll bet most Christians passing by would say, well, okay, that guy's weird. But this is what Jesus has in mind. There's a desperation, there's a sense of urgency that says we need that relationship with God. And having that relationship with Christ means nothing else matters. And it means nothing else that I have means anything. And it means that I long for nothing else but that. Dostoevsky said, blessed are they who have nothing to lock up. John of the Cross called this seeking of nada, except for the presence and power of Jesus. Nothing else matters. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Skipping a few, blessed are the merciful and the peacemakers. They will be shown mercy and will be called the children of God. The key, seven keys to success. You've seen books like that. Seven habits of this, seven habits of that. Showing mercy and being a peacemaker, the key to success. You won't see that book on the shelf. And Jesus makes it worse. It's not just being a peacemaker. It's not just showing mercy. Later in the sermon, he will say, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who persecute you. But what about good old-fashioned vengeance? What about good old-fashioned revenge? good old-fashioned raw revenge. You know that in the ancient world, the people of God in the first century were under the foot of Rome. Under the foot of Rome. And they had choices of how they would live under that situation. And there were some called zealots. One of Jesus' disciples was a zealot. His name is Simon. What did the zealots do? They decided the best way to deal with Rome is to wipe it out. And so one person at a time, whoosh, whoosh, guerrilla warfare, until they themselves were wiped out. Jesus himself predicted it. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. And blessed are you when you are merciful, when you are a peacekeeper, when you love your enemies. Well, that's all good and well, you might say. But what would a saint do? And everybody's going to wake up who's asleep right now. What would a saint do with Islam? What would a saint do with Islam? In all of its many forms. In all of its many forms. We do have a model, by the way. It's a little guy from Assisi. You got a cute little statue out in your yard of St. Francis with a bird. The Fifth Crusade. He told the cardinal, the chaplain of the Fifth Crusade, he said, I want to preach to the Sultan. The Sultan's name was Malik al-Kamil. Malik al-Kamil, that means perfect king. And what did the cardinal tell him? He said, you know what, Muslims only understand weapons. The best thing a Christian could do is kill them. This was the Fifth Crusade. But Francis insisted. He said, I want to preach to the Sultan. And so the cardinal relented. He said, okay, you have my blessing. You go as a martyr. Take your friend Illuminato and go preach to the Sultan. Well, the two brothers went, and on their way to preach to the Sultan, they were captured. They were beaten. And they were brought before al-Kamil. And he said, do you wish to become a Muslim? To Francis. And Francis said, actually, I have come to bring you Jesus. And if I cannot bring you Jesus, I will be beheaded. Well, the two of them actually spent 30 days together, al-Kamil and Francis. And they were able to talk with love and respect. And Francis was able to tell him about Jesus Christ. The Sultan let him go after those 30 days. And actually, he sent him on his way with an ivory horn. That, to this day, is still in the Basilica of Assisi. And it stood for the proclamation of the gospel. We don't know what the Sultan felt about Jesus, but we do know, based on a transcription on his tomb, that his life changed, and I quote, with my experience of a Christian monk. Perhaps not the way, that's not the way we choose to be. Or the way we choose, the path we choose to take. But do we not need a peacemaker like Francis? What about you? What about all of us? Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. The Old Testament and the New Testament both describe this concept of righteousness. And it means all those things that you think it means. It means virtue. It means moral purity. It means holiness. But there's also, it also has a broader connotation. It also means making things right everywhere. So when you say you hunger and thirst for righteousness, you hunger and thirst for a righteousness of your own. But you hunger and thirst that everything around you will be made right. That everything around you will be made right. That there is a rightness and a wholeness about the life around you. Julian of Norwich would say, all will be well, all will be well, all manner of things will be well. The Jewish concept of tzedakah. Again, make me right here, and make us right here, and make it right here. I think there's too many Christians today who came to Christ for fire insurance, and who believe that Christ will come and take this mess that we've made and blow all the bad guys up, and we escape. But that's not the way of salvation. The way is that all things